nostrils. Strange and distinctive, it was a scent he associated with rainfall. Kaladin didn't think he'd been struck directly. Stormforms had trouble aiming their lightning, but it took a moment for Kaladin's stormlight to heal his ears and restore his vision. A shadow moved over him, swinging its axe down. Kaladin twisted to the side just in time. The axe clanged against the ground.
"I'm sorry, Father," Kaladin thought, reaching for the scalpel in his boot.
As the axe fell, Kaladin let it bite him in the left shoulder, praying his stormlight would hold. He rammed the scalpel into the side of the regal's knee, directly between bits of carapace. The regal screamed and stumbled. Kaladin's shoulder hurt like damnation, but he pushed through the pain and leaped to his feet. His stormlight ran out as he rushed his enemy, toppling them again. But this time Kaladin fell with more care and dropped on top of the regal. With the momentum of the fall, he rammed his scalpel into the creature's neck, right above its carapace gorget. The knife wasn't intended for battle, but it was sharpened to exactness. Kaladin twisted it and swiftly cut the carotid artery, then threw himself up. He stumbled back against the counter, covered in sweat, panting, his hearing not fully healed from the blast. The regal thrashed on the floor, and orange blood... Well, Kaladin turned away. Some sights were sickening even for a surgeon. "Even for a soldier," he corrected. "You're no surgeon." He looked across the room at the singer who huddled beside the far wall. He'd watched, stunned, and hadn't intervened.
"Haven't been in many fights, have you?"
Kaladin asked, hoarse. The singer jumped, his eyes wide. He was in war form, so he appeared fearsome, but his expression told another story. That of a person who wanted to be anywhere else, a person horrified by the brutality of the fight.
Storms. He hadn't considered that singers might feel battle shock, too.
"Go," Kaladin said, then winced as the dying regal's leg thumped against the wall with a frantic, panicked sound. Bleeding out always seemed to happen too quickly to your friends, and not quickly enough to those you killed. The singer stared at him, haunted, and Kaladin realized the Malin might also have been deafened by the lightning. Kaladin pointed, mouthing the word, "Go." The singer scrambled away, leaving wet orange footprints from the dying singer's blood. Kaladin pulled himself over to the opposite counter, where a few spheres still glowed. He drew those in and healed the rest of his wounds. He should have kept another pouch on him. This had been coming. He searched out the doorway and found his father on the floor where Kaladin had shoved him, lit by morning light coming in through the distant window. "You all right?" Kaladin asked him. "Did that blast hurt you?" Liren stood up, staring past Kaladin, into the room, square at the dying regal. In the other room, Oradin had started crying. Then Liren, overcoming his shock, scrambled into the room to try to help the dying singer.
"Father is fine," Kaladin thought. The thunder of stormform lightning blasts, at least those made by a single individual, wasn't as bad as that of real lightning.
As long as you were sheltered, as his father had been, you wouldn't suffer permanent hearing loss. Kaladin tiredly glanced to Syl, who sat on the counter with her hands in her lap. Her eyes were closed, her head turned away from the dying regal as Liren tried to staunch the blood flow. Kaladin had killed dozens, perhaps hundreds of them during this war, though he'd tried to focus his attention on the fused. He'd told himself that those fights were more meaningful. But the truth was, he hated killing common soldiers. They never seemed to have much of a chance against him. Yet each fused he killed meant something even worse. A non-combatant would be sacrificed to give that fused new life. So each one of them Kaladin killed meant taking the life of some housewife or craftsman. He moved over to Teft, Kaladin's glowing body illuminating the man, unconscious on the table. Kaladin spared a momentary worry for the stone ward who had been taken. Could he somehow rescue her too?
"Don't be a fool, Kaladin. You barely saved Teft. In fact, you might not have saved him yet. Deal with the current problems before creating new ones."
Nearby, Liren gave up,
lowering his head and slumping in place as he knelt before the body. It had stopped moving, finally.
"We'll need to hide," Kaladin said to his father. "I'll fetch Mother."
He surveyed his bloody clothing.
"Perhaps you should do that, actually."
"How dare you?"
Lirin whispered, his voice hoarse. Kaladin hesitated, shocked.
"How dare you kill in this place?"
Lirin shouted, turning on Kaladin, anger spren pooling at his feet.
"My sanctuary, the place where we heal! What is wrong with you?"
"They were going to take Teft," Kaladin said. "Kill him."
"You don't know that,"
Lirin said. He stared at his bloodied hands.
You just..."
He took a deep breath.
"The Fused are probably gathering the Radiance to keep them in one location and watch to see that none of them wake up."
"You don't know that,"
Kaladin said.
"I wasn't going to let them take him. He's my friend."
"Is that it? Or did you just want an excuse?"
Lirin's hands trembled as he tried to wipe the blood onto his trousers. When he looked back at Kaladin, something seemed to have broken in him, tears on his cheeks. Storms, he seemed exhausted.
"Herald's a buff,"
Lirin whispered.
"They really did kill my boy, didn't they? What have they done to you?"
Kaladin's smidgen of stormlight ran out.
"Damnation. He was so tired. I've tried to tell you. Your boy died years ago."
Lirin stared at the floor, wet with blood.
"Go. They'll come for you now."
"You need to go into hiding with me," Kaladin said. "They'll know you're my..."
"We're not going anywhere with you,"
Lirin snapped.
"Don't play the sixth fool, father," Kaladin said. "You can't let them take you after this."
"I can and will,"
Lirin shouted, standing up.
"Because I will take responsibility for what I've done. I will work within whatever confines I must in order to protect people. I have taken oaths not to harm."
He grimaced, sickened.
"Oh, almighty. You murdered a man inside my home."
"It wasn't murder,"
Kaladin said. Lirin didn't respond.
"It wasn't murder."
Lirin sank to the floor.
"Just go,"
he said, his voice growing soft again. The grief in it, the disappointment, was far worse than the anger had been.
"I will find a way to get the rest of us out of this. That singer saw me trying to make you stop. They won't harm a surgeon who didn't fight. But you, they'll kill."
Kaladin hesitated. Could he really leave them here?
"Storms,"
Lirin whispered.
"Storms, my son has become a monster."
Kaladin steeled himself, then slipped into the back room and recovered an extra pouch of spheres he kept there. Then he returned to the exam room, trying and failing to avoid the blood. He lifted Teft with a grunt, putting him in a medic's carry across his back.
"I've taken oaths too, father," he said. "I'm sorry I'm not the man you wanted me to be. But if I were a monster, I would never have let that other soldier go."
He left, running from the uninhabited center of the sixth floor as shouts in the singer tongue began to sound behind him. The end of part two. Interludes. Vire, Lift, Taravangian. Interlude 4. Vire. Vire was unchained. Moash, the man he'd once been, had lived his entire life chained up and never known it. Oh, he'd recognized the bonds the Light Eyes used on him. He'd experienced their tyranny both directly and indirectly, most painfully in the deaths of those he loved, left locked away in their dungeons. But he hadn't recognized the truer chains, the ones that bound his soul, constraining him to mere mortality when he could always have been so much more. Byer threw his shard blade with a wide overhand throw. Sunlight flashed along the spinning blade as it soared across the quarry and then clanged against a large rock before bouncing free, tearing a gash in the ground, then finally coming to rest wedged in the stone.
"I still don't understand what you're doing, Vire," Ken said to confusion.
Warform suited her. It always had.
"That weapon was not meant to be thrown."
They worked together in the quarry, which had been created by mining through the Krem many feet down to reach marble, outside of Kolinar. As usual, his small band of singers went where he did and started working, quietly, as he did. Moments earlier, Vire had been cutting stones out with his blade. Now, his attention had turned inward, toward chains and bindings and prisons unseen. He gestured, and the distant shard blade vanished to mist. Yet it took him 10 heartbeats to summon it again.
"I saw Prince Adolin throw his blade," Byer said.
3 months ago, on the battlefield in northern Yakaved. He is no radiant, yet his blade responds to him as if he were one.
Maybe it was just a lucky throw."
Byer threw his blade again. It clanged uselessly off his target. He narrowed his eyes, then dismissed it into a puff of mist.
"No," Vire said. "He must be able to change the balance to allow for this maneuver. And it returned to him faster than 10 heartbeats, even accounting for the accelerated pulse of battle."
Vire waited until the weapon appeared in his grip. This was an ancient weapon, one of the mighty honor blades. Yet it was inferior. It couldn't change shape and cost far more stormlight to use, often crusting his clothing with frost when he used it too quickly. He didn't feel anger at his blade's inferiority, or humiliation. The lack of those emotions let him consider the situation clearly, fueling his curiosity, his determination. This was what it was like to be unchained. To be freed from captivity, to never again feel guilt. He strode through the quarry. 1,000 clinks of metal on stone surrounded him, like the dancing feet of Kremlings. An overcast sky and a calm wind chilled his skin as he picked a new section of the quarry in which to work. He began slicing at the wall to cut free another large block of precious marble.
"Vire," Ken said,
to determination, curious. What did she want that made her so afraid?
I am leaving.
Very well, Vire said, working.
You're not angry?
I can't be angry, he said truthfully. Nor can I feel disappointment. After all these months together, she still didn't understand, because she rushed to explain, worried he'd be upset despite what he'd said.
I don't want to go on these raids and fight anymore, Vire. I feel like I woke up to life and then immediately started killing. I want to see what it is like to live, really live, with my own mind, my own passions.
Very well, Vire said. She hummed to reconciliation.
You are chained, Hien, Vire explained.
You haven't given your negative emotions to him. Your insecurities, your fears, your pain. I was like you for many years. He narrowed his eyes, turning and looking to the west, toward him. Then I took the chains off and saw what I could truly become. She hummed to, was that curiosity? Yes, he thought it was.
What? Vire asked. You say you're unburdened, Vire, she said, that you don't care anymore, but you keep hunting him, the Windrunner.
At the mention of Kaladin, Moash felt a hint of old, painful emotions, though Odium quickly sucked them away. "Kaladin is a friend," Moash said. "It is important to me that he find his freedom. Go your way, Hien. If you become unchained in the future, seek me out. You are a capable warrior, and I would fight beside you again." Vyre heaved a rock onto his right shoulder and began hauling it out of the quarry. The others remained in place, working. Vyre enjoyed hauling rocks. Simple work was best to pass the time. It reminded him of days spent walking with caravans, except this was better because it tired out his body but left him capable of thinking on his curious state, his new state. Large stone settled on his shoulder, he hiked steadily up the path toward Kolinar. The marble was heavy, but not so much that he needed stormlight or supernatural help. That would defeat the purpose. For a time he walked, happy with his status. And he thought about Kaladin. Poor Kaladin. There was freedom available for his old friend. Two freedoms, in fact. But he doubted Kaladin would ever accept the same freedom as Vyre, so he offered the other one. The sweet peace of non-existence. Hien was correct in questioning Vyre. So many things that had once been important didn't bother him any longer, so why did Kaladin tease at him, draw his attention? Why did Kaladin always make the old emotions churn again, if briefly? There was one chain still holding to him, Vyre admitted, that of his friend. I have to be right, Vyre thought, and he has to be wrong. Kaladin had to acknowledge that Vyre was right. Until he did, that last chain would remain. Vyre eventually reached Kolinar and passed through the gates. The city had well and truly settled into its new existence. The peoples intermixed, though singers were properly given deference. They were models of behavior the humans needed to learn to follow. When disputes happened, the singers forced men to be fair to one another. After all, when the parents came home, it was their duty to remove privileges if they found a mess. Humankind had been given millennia to prove they could self-govern properly, and they had failed. People stared at him. He wasn't wearing his uniform, and he'd covered his Bridge 4 shoulder tattoo with elbow-length sleeves. He was not distinctive. Yet he was, for they knew him. They whispered of him. Vyre, he who quiets. He who hauls rocks. Vyre soon reached a building site near the District of Colors. Here, workers were constructing special housing for some of the deepest ones. Each brand of fused had its particularities. These liked to have homes without floors, so they could touch the natural stone ground with their unshod feet. They could move through other materials, too, so long as they were solid. But they liked the feeling of uncut stone underfoot, stretching to the heart of Roshar. So Vyre's marble would be used for the walls. Vyre hadn't been asked to help with this job. If negative emotions could rule him, he suspected he'd have been annoyed at their neglect. Hard labor in the city? Not telling him was like hiding sweets from a child. Fortunately, he'd found out about it a few days ago, and had started cutting his own rocks and hauling them. Vyre set his block of marble down by the mason's station where they were honing them. Then he helped unload a cart that had pulled in from the other quarry, full to the brim. One stone at a time, heave, haul, drop. It was excellent work. Difficult. Grueling. He was so lost in the effort that when the chul carts were all empty, he dusted his hands off and was surprised to find himself virtually alone. When had the masons and other workers left? It wasn't yet midday. "Where is everyone?" he asked the chul keeper, who was quickly gathering his beasts to take them to their pen. "Ever storm tonight, Bright Lord.
We were given a half day off in celebration.
I'm not a bright lord, Vyra said, checking the sky, though, as he now recalled, the storm wouldn't arrive for many more hours. But it was likely approaching Urethiru right now. The armies were preparing to attack. Well, he'd been told to stay back from that fight, so he looked at the Chellkeeper. How much more stone do you need?
Well, Lord Silencer, sir, yes, we need about double what we have now. There's a pile at the second quarry, but we have chulls and carts to—
We shouldn't let the chulls have all the fun, Byer said, turning and walking along the road toward the city gates. Before Vyra reached the gates, however, he was taken into a vision. He materialized on a vast field of golden light. Odium was there, 100 feet tall, seated on a throne. In the guise of a mighty fused, majestic like a king should be. Vyra walked closer and knelt. You can take me without a storm now, Lord.
Our connection grows stronger, Odium said. I haven't needed a storm to bring you into a vision for months now, Vyra. I usually do it for tradition's sake.
That made sense. Vyra waited for further instructions.
I've noticed you walking freely about in storms on previous days, Vyra, Odium said, his voice like thunder. You have given me your worst emotions, but you should maintain a sense of self-preservation. Fear of my majesty. Why are you not wary of the lightning?
You won't strike me down, Vyra said.
How do you know this?
I haven't finished what I'm supposed to do, Vyra said. I still have a truth to prove.
Interesting, Odium said. You respond to my gift in such an odd way. You are becoming something I have never before created, Vyra.
Some people say I've become your avatar, Vyra said. That you act through me, control me.
Odium laughed.
As if I would give such power to a mortal. No, Vyra. You are uniquely yourself. So interesting.
I am unchained.
And yet you think so often of Caladan.
I am mostly unchained.
Odium leaned forward, lightning crackling across his carapaced body.
I need you at Urethiru. We cannot make the oath gates work, and so I need you to transport the ground forces. I suspect your sword will still function.
I will go right away, Vyra said. But I thought you didn't want me there.
I worry about the effect your friend has on you. The Windrunner.
You needn't worry. Those emotions belong to you now.
Indeed.
Odium leaned closer.
Your friend is a problem to me. A bigger problem than I had assumed. I have foreseen that he will continue to be one.
That was not surprising. Caladan was a problem to many.
He has left the battle which I hadn't thought him capable of doing, Odium said. Strangely, this will make him far more dangerous in the future, unless we act. But I cannot strike him down directly. Not unless he puts himself into my hands.
Caladan can't be killed, Vyra said.
He knew it, sure as he knew the sun was hot and that it circled Roshar forever.
Not even by you?
Especially not by me.
I do not think that is true, Vyra, though I understand why you think it so. I feel your passions as they are mine. I understand you.
Vyra remained kneeling.
I would claim this one as I have claimed you, Odium said.
And Vyra would see him dead first. A mercy.
Can you think of a way to hurt him? Odium asked. Drive him toward me?
Isolate him. Take away his friends.
He will soon be alone.
Then make him afraid. Make him dread. Break him.
How?
Vyr looked up across the endless field of golden stone. How do you bring me here?
This is not a place, but a warping of the realms, a vision.
Could you show me anything?
Yes.
Could you show him anything?
I haven't the connection to him.
Odium considered, humming softly to a rhythm.
I see a way. There are holes in his soul. Someone could get in. Someone who knows him. Someone connected to him. Someone who feels as he does.
I will do it.
Perhaps. You could influence him in small ways only. Perhaps each night when he slumbers. He thinks of you still, and there is more. A connection because of your past, your shared dreams. Any bond such as that can be manipulated. Will this be enough? If we show him visions, will that break him?
It will be a start. I can bring him to the brink. Get him to step up to the ledge.
Then what?
Then we find a way to make him jump, Moash said softly.
Shallan's sketchbook. Cultivation Spren. Cultivation Spren seem to be composed of living vines that interweave in subtle patterns, like finely woven cloth, whose weave is nearly invisible to human eyes. They often act as traders and merchants in Shadesmar, and as such, they maintain relations with almost every group of Spren, even those who are normally hostile to each other. Their hands, eyes, and teeth appear to be made of perfect crystal, clear yet filled with reflections of light. Their hands are as flexible and mobile as flesh, but their teeth appear firm as bone. In the physical realm, they most often appear as a rippling river of vines and crystals that sprout, weave, and shatter into dust within moments as they move sinuously across a surface. Sometimes they appear with an expressive human-like face that resembles the one they bear in the cognitive realm. Interlude 5. Lift. As Lift hung from the ceiling, dangling precariously from a rope with one hand, reaching out with the other toward the basket, she was forced to acknowledge that stealing food just didn't give her the same thrill it once had. She continued to pretend because she didn't want her life to change. She hated change. Stealing people's food was basically her thing. She'd been doing it for years, and she did get a thrill when she saw their starving faces. They'd turn away. Then when they looked back, their chowder wrap would be gone, or they'd lift the cover on their meal and find the plate empty. After that came the most sublime moment of cross-eyed panic and confusion. But then they'd smile and look to see where she was. They didn't see her, of course. She was way too good at hiding. But they'd look, and they seemed fond. You weren't supposed to be fond when someone stole from you, ruined the entire experience. Then there was this. She stretched a little farther, fingers brushing the basket. There. She snatched the handle. She stuffed the handle between her teeth, scuttled up the rope, then vanished into the hidden labyrinth of small tunnels that latticed the ceilings and walls of Urethiru. Up here, Windle waited, coiled up on himself and making a face out of vines and crystal. Oh, he said. A full basket. Let's see what he left you this time. Ain't nobody leaving me nothing, Lift snapped. I stole it, unfair and square. Also, hush, someone might hear.
They can't hear me, mistress.
I can hear you. So hush, whiny Spren. She crept down the tunnel. There was an everstorm going on right now, and she wanted to be safe at her nest. The things felt creepy in ways that the other Radiants didn't seem to notice. And even though everything seemed normal in the tower, she couldn't help noticing the strange sensation that everything was wrong. She felt that every time, though. So today, she just pushed the basket ahead of her. She crawled through the small tunnel. The next intersection was a tight squeeze, but she could make herself slick with stormlight, so she got through. Two turns and a straight crawl later, they entered a small intersection where she'd left a sphere for light. The roof of the tunnel was a little higher here, letting her settle with her back against the stone wall so she could inspect her prize. Windle came in on the ceiling, taking the shape of a growing vine that crept across the stone. He formed a face again right above her as she rifled through the basket. Flatbread, some curry, sugared mashed beans, a little jar of jam with a cute face drawn on top, above the horn-eater symbol for love. Lift glanced up at the ceiling and the blinking vine face hanging from it. Fine, she admitted. Maybe he left it out for me.
Maybe.
Starving, stupid horn-eater boy, Lift grumbled, slathering jam on the flatbread. His dad knew how to make it appear like an accident, leaving stuff out so I could take it. Let me storm and pretend. She stuffed the bread into her mouth. Damnation, it was good. Only made the experience more humiliating.
I don't see the problem, mistress, Windle said.
That's 'cause you're a dummy, Spren, she said, then stuffed the rest of the flatbread into her mouth, talking around it.
I love to have the fun in life. I do too like fun in my life, he said. Last month, with the help of some human children, I displayed the most beautiful art installation of chairs. The other cultivation, Spren, thought it quite majestic. They complimented the stools in particular.
Lift sighed, leaning back, slumping there. Too annoyed to even make a good stool joke. She wasn't really angry, wasn't really sad, just blargle-gorf, supremely blargle-gorf. Storms. The wrap she wore underneath her shirt was itchy today. Come on, she said, grabbing the basket and sphere, then moving on through the tower's innards.
Is it really so bad? Windle said, following. Gift likes you. That is why he leaves things out for you.
I'm not supposed to be liked, Lift snapped. I'm a shadow. A dangerous and unknown shadow. Moving mysteriously from place to place. Never seen. Always feared.
Shadow.
Yes, a starving shadow, all right. She had to squeeze through the next tunnel, too. Stupid, stupid, stupid. This tower, it's like a big old corpse. And I'm like blood, sneaking around through its veins.
Why would a corpse have blood in its veins?
Fine, it's not dead. It's sleeping, and we are its storming blood, all right?
I should think, Windle said. These air vents are much more like intestines. So the allegory would make you more akin to, feces, I guess.
Windle, she said, pulling through.
Yes, mistress?
Maybe stop trying to help with my DV metaphors.
Yes, all right.
Storming lame Spren, she muttered, finally reaching a section of larger air vents. She did like this tower. There were a lot of places to hide and to explore. Up here in this network of stone ventilation shafts, she found the occasional mink or other scavenger, but it was actually her domain. The adults were too big, and the other children too frightened. Plus, she could glow when properly fed, and her awesomeness could get her through tight squeezes. A year ago, there hadn't been nearly as many of those as there were now. Stupid, stupid, stupid. They eventually reached her nest, a large opening where four tall ventilation shafts met. Here she'd piled up blankets, food stores, and some treasures. One of Dalinar's knives she was absolutely sure he hadn't wanted her to steal, some interesting shells, an old flute that Wendell said looked strange. They were near a well where she could get all the water she wanted, but far enough away from people that she could talk freely. Her previous nest had let her listen in on the echoes of people nearby, but they'd also been able to hear her. She'd heard them talking about the echoing, the spirit of the tower, they'd called her. That had been nifty at first, but then they'd started leaving stuff out for her, like she was the Stormin' Night Watcher, and she'd started feeling guilty. You can't be taking stuff from people who don't have much. That was the first rule of not being a total and utter useless piece of chul dung. She munched on more of the stolen food from her basket, then sighed and got up. She stepped up to a side wall, putting her back to the stone. "Come on," she said. "Do it." Wendell moved up the wall. As always, he left a trail of vines behind him. They would crumble and decay soon after, but could be used to mark something for a short time. He moved across the wall atop her head. Then she turned around and marked the line with a more permanent one out of chalk. "That's almost a full inch since last time," she said.
"I'm sorry, mistress."
She flopped down in her nest of blankets, wanting to curl up and cry. "I'll stop eating," she said. "That'll stunt my growth."
"You," Wendell said.
"Stop eating. Storming Spren." She pulled off her shirt, redid the wrap, tighter, although it pinched her skin, then replaced her shirt. After that, she lay and stared up at the marks on the wall, which showed the progress of her height over the last year.
"Mistress," Wendell said, curling up like an eel and raising a vine head beside her.
He was getting better at making faces, and this one was one of her favorites. It had vines that looked like little mustaches.
"Don't you think it's time you told me what exactly it was you asked the Night Watcher?"
"Doesn't matter," she said. "It was all lies. The boon, the promises. Lies, lies, lies."
"I have met the Night Watcher," Wendell said. "She does not think the same way the rest of us do. Cultivation created her to be apart, separated from humankind, unconnected. Mortal perception of the Night Watcher does not influence her like it does other Spren. Mother wanted a daughter whose shape and personality would grow organically. This makes the Night Watcher less, well, human than a Spren like me. Still, I don't believe her capable of lying. It isn't something she could conceive of, I believe."
"She's not the liar,"
Lift said, closing her eyes. "Storms. She'd made the wrap too tight. She could barely breathe."
"It's the other one. The one with a dress like leaves, merging into the underbrush. Hair like twigs. Skin the color of deep brown stone."
"So you did see cultivation herself. Both you and Dalinar. Mother has been intervening far more than we assumed, but behind a cloud of subterfuge, she uses tales of the old magic to distract, and to make it less obvious, the specific ones she is drawing to her." Lift shrugged. "I had suspected it was true. Your situation is unique. Why, seeing into the cognitive realm, even a little, is an uncommon feature in a human, and turning food into light,
Why, if Mother is involved, perhaps this isn't Stormlight you use at all. You realize how special you are, Lift.
I didn't want to be special,
says the girl who was comparing herself so dramatically to a shadow earlier.
I just wanted what I asked for.
Which was? Wendell asked.
Not important now.
I rather think it is.
I asked not to change,
Lift whispered, opening her eyes.
I said, when everything else is going wrong, I want to be the same. I want to stay me, not become someone else.
Those are the exact words? Wendell asked.
Best I can remember.
Wendell said, snuggling down into his vines. I believe that is too vague.
I wasn't. I told her. Make me so I don't grow up.
That is not what you said, mistress. And if I might be so bold, having spent a great deal of time around you, you are not an easy person to understand.
I asked not to change. So why am I changing?
You're still you, merely a bigger version. She squeezed her eyes shut again. Mistress, Wendell said. Lift, will you tell me why this bothers you so much? Everyone grows. Everyone changes.
But I'm her little girl.
Whose little girl? He asked gently. Your mother's?
Lift nodded. Stupid. It sounded stupid and she was stupid. Mother was dead. That was that. Why hadn't she said the correct words? Why hadn't Cultivation just understood? Cultivation was supposed to be some sort of starving god. It was her fault if a little girl came and begged for a promise, and the god deliberately misinterpreted and Lift liked who she was, who she had been. She wouldn't be the same when she got older. Crawl through dark tunnels? Sure. Fight against fused? Why not? But feel your own body changing you into someone else and not be able to stop it? Every human being lived with a terrible terror, and they all ignored it. Their own bodies mutated and elongated and started bleeding and became all wrong. Nobody talked about it. Nobody was scared of it. What was wrong with them? The last time things felt right, Lift thought, I was with her, before she got sick, and I was her little girl. If she saw me now, she wouldn't recognize me. A few strange spren, like faces mocking her, faded in nearby. Wendell slowly wrapped his vines around her, gentle, like an embrace. Though others could barely feel the touch of their spren, Wendell felt solid to her. He wasn't warm, but it was comforting when he rested his vine head on her shoulder. For once he didn't ruin the sentiment by saying something dumb. And then he perked up in a suspicious-like way. Lift wiped her eyes. What? She demanded.
I don't know, Wendell said. Something just happened. In the tower, I feel a darkness resting on me like a blanket. I think I felt the tower stir.
You said the tower's spren was dead.
Dead spren can stir, Lift, Wendell said. Something is wrong. Something is very wrong.
Lift grabbed a large piece of flatbread and stuffed it in her mouth. Then she scurried through the tunnels, Wendell following. She tried to use Stormlight to make her body slick to get through a particularly tight squeeze, but it didn't work. She frowned, tried again, then finally forced herself through without it. What on Roshar? She came out above an empty room at the perimeter of the tower. She dropped from the opening in the ceiling, then trotted to the window. It was nearing evening, and the Everstorm had passed.
Nothing looked wrong about the tower from her vantage. Just an average day up in the mountains. "Something's wrong with my powers," she whispered, as Windle lowered himself from the top of the windowsill. "I couldn't become awesome. Look, down there." Some people had gathered on the Oathgate platform to the shattered planes, several figures who seemed to have fallen to the ground, blue uniforms. "Windrunners," she said, squinting. "Something's wrong with them. Maybe they broke the oath gates?"
"Maybe."
Lift searched out across the snowy landscape, trying to listen. "Listen," the sleepless had told her. "Always listen." She heard screams, but not human ones. "There," she said, pointing. "What's that?" A bright red something was flying through the air in a desperate loop, being chased by something else that was green, faster, more dangerous. The two collided in midair, and when the red something tore away, it dropped feathers in the sky. Chickens. Flying chickens. She didn't need to be told to instinctively understand that the green one was the predator, while the red one was prey. It gave a few beleaguered flaps toward the tower, seeming barely able to stay in the air. "Come on," Lift said, swinging out the window. "I need handholds."
"Oh, mistress," Windle said, moving on to the outside of the tower.
He wove back and forth to make a ladder of vines clinging to the stone, which she climbed.
"We are far too high for this. What if I drop?"
"You're a stormin' spren. You'd be fine."
"We don't know that," he said. "I could fall hundreds of feet."
"Coward spren."
"Wisdom spren, if anything," he said, but kept weaving as she scrambled upward.
The red chicken barely dodged another attack in the sky before darting in toward a balcony above and vanishing from her sight. The green chicken rounded, and she got a good look at it. Wicked talons, a sharp knife-like beak. She'd always thought chickens looked silly, but this one was different. She reached the balcony and found the red one on the floor, bleeding from one wing, trying weakly to right itself. It was bigger than she'd thought, at least a foot tall, with a vivid red body and head. It had bright blue wings that went red at the ends, like fire. It chirped weakly as it saw her. She perched on the rim of the balcony and turned to see the green one coming in.
"Windle, I need you,"
she said, holding her hand to the side to make him into a weapon. Not a sword. She hated those things. A rod she could swing at the nightmare chicken. Nothing happened.
"I can't become a weapon, mistress," Windle cried. "I don't know why. It's something about the wrongness in the tower."
"Fine. She didn't need a weapon anyway." The green chicken came swooping toward her, claws extended. It seemed to expect her to flinch, so she didn't. She took the hit directly in the face and grabbed the chicken as it tried to rake her with its claws. Then she bit it, right on the wing. Its startled scream seemed more confused than pained, but it tore out of her grip and fluttered away, crying as if it thought Lift wasn't playing fair. She spat out a feather as Stormlight healed the cuts to her face. Well, at least that part of her abilities was still working. She hopped down and scooped up the wounded red-feathered chicken. It gave her a timid bite on the arm, and she glared at it.
"You ain't in any position to complain," she said, then tried to heal it.
She pressed her light into the body, and it resisted. The healing didn't work either.
Damnation!
The chicken calmed as she hurried into the room beyond, where a young light-eyed man had been walking to the balcony to see what the fuss was.
"Sorry," Lift said. "Important radiant business."
As he leaped back, startled, she snatched a lima fruit off his table, then hurried out into the hallway beyond.
"Let's see. Fifth floor."
She found her way to one of the ventilation openings, and Windle made a ladder for her to climb up,
the red chicken under her arm, complaining softly about the treatment. Inside, safely around a few corners, she put the chicken on the floor, then pressed her hand to it again. She pushed harder. When she'd tried to become awesome earlier, nothing had happened. But when she'd tried to heal, she'd felt something different, a resistance. So this time she pushed it, growling softly until it worked. Stormlight left her, and the chicken's wing healed. Her powers didn't regrow the lost feathers, but in a moment the thing had rolled over and was picking at the bare skin on its side with a tentative beak. Finally, it looked at her and released a confused squawk. "It's kind of what I do," she said, and shrugged. "I'm supposed to listen, too. Damnation take me if I can figure out how that applies to chickens, though." The chicken squawked. She tried to summon her awesomeness, but that power didn't merely resist. It seemed to not exist. As she tried again, she heard something odd. People shouting? "Wendell?" she asked. He moved away as a vine. People could sometimes notice the remnants of those vines when they disintegrated, but he himself was invisible. The chicken began walking away down the tunnel. It had a funny stride, like it was indignant about being forced to use its feet. Lift hurried forward and blocked it off. "Where do you think you're going?" It squawked insistently, then squeezed past her. "At least wait for Wendell," she said, blocking it off again. It let out a more threatening squawk, but soon Wendell returned.
"Radiants are dropping unconscious," he said. "Oh, mistress, this seems very bad."
The chicken, uncaring, pushed past her and continued along the tunnel. Together, she and Wendell followed, the Spren growing increasingly worried, particularly after the bird fluttered down into a corridor, then stared at the ground and chirped in an annoyed way. It turned toward her, plaintive.
"You need to go down lower," she said. "But you don't know how? What are you following?"
It squawked.
"Mistress," Wendell said, "chickens are not intelligent. Talking to one would make me question your intelligence if I hadn't seen you talk to Kremlings sometimes."
"Never can tell if one of those is reporting back to someone or not," she muttered, then climbed down and picked up the chicken. It seemed to have trouble flying without all its feathers, so she carried it as they used the stairs to descend several levels, following the chicken's body language. It would stretch out its head, then cock it, looking at the floor with one eye. When they got to the second level, it leveled out its head, staring insistently along a corridor, and made a kind of hooting noise. Something distant rumbled from one of the corridors behind them. Lift spun, and Wendell whimpered. "That was thunder," she said. "There are storm forms in the tower."
"Oh, mistress," Wendell cried. "We should do something, like hide, or run away and then hide."
Instead, she followed the chicken's gaze. She was supposed to listen. It was one of her stormin' oaths or something. She hurried through a side passage as the chicken started to squawk louder.
"Mistress," Wendell said, "why are we?"
He trailed off as they stumbled across the corpse. It was an old Alethi man in robes. He'd been killed with some kind of knife wound to the chest and lay, his eyes open, on the ground, blood on his lips. She turned away. She never had gotten used to this sort of thing. The chicken let out an angry screech, fluttering out of her hands to the man. Then, in perhaps the most heart-wrenching thing she'd ever seen, it began to nuzzle the corpse and chirp softly. It climbed into the crook of his dead arm and pushed its head against his side, chirping again, more worried this time.
"I'm sorry," Lift said, squatting down. "How did you know he was here?"
It chirped.
"You could feel him, couldn't you?" she asked. "Or you could feel where he'd been."
You're no ordinary chicken. Are you a void-bringer chicken?
Why, Wendell said, do you insist on using that word? It's horribly inaccurate.
Shut it, void-bringer, she muttered at him. She reached over and carefully picked up the chicken, who had begun to let out pained chirps, almost like words, eerily similar to them, in fact.
Who was he? She asked. Wendell, do you recognize him?
I believe I've seen him before. A minor Alethi functionary, though his eyes are different now. Curious. Look at his fingers. Tan skin with bands of lighter skin. He was wearing jewelry once.
Yes. Thinking about it, she thought she recognized him. One of the old people in the tower. Retired, once an important official in the palace. She'd gone and talked to him because nobody paid attention to old people. They smelled.
Robbed, she said. Back alley killings still happened in this tower, though the Colins tried to make the place safe.
I'll remember you, I promise.
Something moved in the darkness nearby. A kind of scraping sound, like feathers. Lift went alert and stood, holding out a sphere for light. It had come from farther down the corridor, where her light didn't reach. Something flowed from that darkness. A man, tall with scarred features. He wore an Alethi uniform, but she swore she'd never seen him before. She would recognize a man this dangerous. Those eyes seemed to be part of the darkness, deep in shadow as he stepped into the light. On his shoulder sat the green chicken from before, its wicked claws gripping a patch of leather affixed to the uniform.
Little Radiant, the man said. I'll admit, I've always wanted an excuse to hunt you.
She clutched her red chicken and started running. The man behind her laughed, as if he'd been given the grandest of gifts.
Interlude 6. A Boon and a Curse. Taravangian's solitude was painful today. As was increasingly common, he wasn't particularly smart. Smart Taravangian hated company. Smart Taravangian forgot the point of being around other people. Smart Taravangian was terrifying. But he would gladly have been that version of himself today. He would have welcomed the emotional anesthesia. He sat alone in a storm wagon, hands in his lap, surrounded by swirling brown exhaustion spren. The Everstorm was nearing its end. He was now to give the order for his men to betray the Coalition. If Taravangian's guesses were right, it also meant Odium had launched an attack on Eurythiru. Taravangian did not give the order yet. Odium had said he would come to confirm, and so far he hadn't. Perhaps Taravangian's service wouldn't be needed today. Perhaps the plan had changed. Weak, frail hopes for a weak, frail man. He so wished he could be smart. When had he last been intelligent? Not brilliant. He'd given up on feeling that way again, but merely smart. The last time had been storms over a year ago, when he'd planned how to destroy Dalinar. That attempt had failed. Dalinar had refused to be broken. Smart Taravangian, for all his capacities, had proven insufficient.
Smart Taravangian came up with the plan that forced Odium to make a deal. He thought. That is enough.
And yet he wavered. Smart Taravangian had failed. Besides, he hadn't just been made intelligent. He'd been given a boon and a curse. Intelligence on one side, compassion on the other. When smart, he assumed the compassion was the curse. But was it really? or was the curse that he could never have both at once? He stood up in the wagon and withstood the moment of dizziness that took him each time he stood these days, blackness creeping at the edges of his vision, like death's Bren eager to claim him. He thought perhaps it was his heart, though he had not asked for a surgeon. Best not to trouble someone who could be helping wounded soldiers. He breathed out in short breaths, listening to the soft cracks of the Everstorm outside. The thunder was ebbing, almost at an end. He shuffled the short distance to his trunk. Here, Taravangian forced himself to kneel. Storms, when had kneeling become so painful? His bones ground against one another like a pestle against its bowl. Trying not to focus on the pain spren, he fumbled at the lock's combination with trembling fingers, then unhooked the lid. He undid the trunk's lining on the top, reached to the secret compartment, and flipped a hidden latch. That disengaged the small ink vial he'd rigged to spill and ruin the contents of the compartment, if it was tampered with. Only then could he feel around inside and locate the pages. He pulled them out with a tentative hand. A year ago, during his most recent bout of intelligence, he'd created this. A few pages from the diagram, cut out and rearranged with some scribbled notes. He'd burned his copy of the book itself, but had kept this excised section. Exhausted, he crawled to his chair and struggled into the seat. Wheezing, he cradled the old sheets from the diagram, then tried to shoo away the exhaustion spren. When he'd created this little section, he hadn't been as smart as he'd been on that singular day, now 7 years gone, when he'd created the diagram. On that day, he'd been a god. On the day when he'd created this fragment a year ago, he'd considered himself a prophet to that god. So what was he now? A priest? A humble follower? A fool? In a way, it felt a betrayal to think in religious terms. This was not the act of gods, but men. No, a god made you what you are. He held up the pages and read through them, squinting without his reading spectacles. The cramped handwriting listed instructions, spliced together with original pieces of the diagram. Most of it detailed the ploy to unseat Dalinar by the careful reveal of secrets, a plan designed to bring the poor man to his knees, to turn the coalition against him. In the end, that ploy had only galvanized the Blackthorn and increased his suspicion of Taravangian. Before that day, they had been friends. Taravangian turned this page over in his fingers, trying to understand the strange creature he became when intelligent. A being unburdened by empathy, capable of seeing straight to the heart of matters, yet also a being who couldn't understand the context of his efforts. He would work to preserve a people at the same time he casually ordered the deaths of children. Smart Taravangian knew the how, but not the why. Dumb Taravangian didn't make connections, didn't remember things quickly, couldn't compute in his head. In this document, intended to demoralize, defame, and destroy a man he dearly respected, dumb Taravangian found pain. He was weeping by the time he finished reading it, and the exhaustion spren had been replaced by the white petals of shame spren.
All this, he thought, to save a handful of people?
He'd preserved Carbronth by selling out the rest of humankind. He was certain Odium could not be defeated, and so saving a remnant was the only logical path. Right now, that seemed pathetic. Smart Taravangian considered himself so brilliant, so masterful. But this was the best he could do? It was a dangerous line of thought, and pointless. Hadn't he told off Mral for making this very argument? They had to focus on what they could do. Smart Taravangian understood that and had accomplished it. Dom Teravangian instead wept for all the people he had failed. All the people who would die when Odium scoured the world of humankind. Teravangian looked back at the notes and today saw something new in them. A small comment about a specific person. Why specifically can't the diagram see Renarin Kolin? The notes read. Why is he invisible? Smart Teravangian had moved on quickly from this question. Why waste time on something minor that you couldn't solve? Dumb Teravangian lingered on it, remembering a later time when he'd been visited by Odium. Odium had shown Teravangian something, and Renarin Kolin had appeared as a chain of blacked-out futures, unseeable. The wagon began to grow lighter around Teravangian. He cursed under his breath, quickly folding the papers together and hiding them in the pocket of his robes. In an instant, the storm wagon melted away, walls vanishing before a brilliant golden light. The floor changed, and Teravangian found himself sitting in his chair on a brilliant field, the ground made as if from solid gold. A figure stood in front of him, a 20-foot-tall human bearing a scepter. His features were shin, and his hair and beard were completely gold, as if he were Iriali. Odium's robes were more ornate than last time, red and gold, with a sword tied at the waist. It was a presentation meant to stun and awe, and Teravangian couldn't help but gasp. It was so gorgeous. He forced himself out of his seat, falling again on painful knees, bowing his head but unable to tear his eyes away from the magnificent display.
"I prefer you when you are like this, Teravangian," Odium said with a powerful voice. "You may not think as quickly, but you do understand more quickly."
"My lord," Teravangian said, "is it time?"
"Yes," Odium said. "You are to send the orders."
"It will be done."
"Will they obey, Teravangian? You ask them to turn against their allies, to side with the enemy."
"The Alethi are their enemies, Lord," Teravangian said. "The Vedans have hated their neighbors for centuries. Plus, their new leaders, installed by your own hand, are hungry for power. They believe you will reward them."
They had not obtained promises. A god could be bound, but only by oaths. These foolish men believed that they'd be rewarded above the others, but Teravangian knew their entire country was doomed. Every human in those lands would eventually be destroyed. They were oblivious of this fate, and Teravangian was confident they would do as they were told and attack their former allies. He had spent a year preparing them, promoting the right men at Odium's command, subtly indicating to all who followed him that the war was a problem for Alethkar and Aesir, not for Yaakoved, that the enemy would never come for them. He looked up to find the god inspecting him with a curious expression.
"Do you not fear death, Teravangian?" Odium asked. "You know you are doomed." Teravangian
trembled.
He tried not to think about it too much, particularly when he was stupid, because, yes, he did fear death. He feared it terribly. He hoped that beyond death there was nothing, oblivion. For if anything else awaited him, it would not be pleasant.
"I do fear it,"
he whispered.
"So honest, this version of you," Odium said.
He walked around Teravangian, who continued to kneel.
"I much prefer it, yes. There is a straightforwardness to your passion."
"Could you not spare them?"
Teravangian asked, tears in his eyes.
"The people of Yaakoved, the Iriali, those who come too willingly. Why waste their lives?"
Oh, I will not waste them, Teravangian, Odium said. Their lives will be spent as they expect, in war, in glory, in blood. I will give them exactly what they've been asking for. They don't know it, but they beg me for death and their requests for power. Only you have begged me for peace.
He looked to Teravangian.
Cabranth will remain an eye of calm in the storm to come. Do not let the others concern you. They will fight in the war they've been promised since birth, and though it will consume and destroy them, they will enjoy it. I shall make certain of that fact. Even if they will not be led in this glory by the one who should have been their king.
As the god mused, Teravangian noticed something. A light emanating from Odium. It pulsed, making his skin transparent, glowing from within. There was a sickly feel to it somehow. Indeed, Odium stopped and seemed to concentrate, making the light retreat before continuing.
I have failed in many ways.
But you failed too, Teravangian thought at the god. The one who should have been their king was in reference to Dalinar. Odium had been planning for something for many years, a war far greater even than the one that now consumed Roshar, some strange battle for the heavens. He had wanted Dalinar for this war, but had failed to secure him. Odium still intended to use all of humankind as his frontline troops once he won Roshar. He would throw their lives away, turn them into slaves focused on fueling his war for the heavens. He would use their blood to preserve the singers, which Odium saw as more valuable troops. Merely considering all this horrified Teravangian. It was even worse than the quick and swift destruction he'd been imagining. This would be a drawn-out nightmare of slavery, blood, and death. Yet one thought comforted him. One that smart Teravangian would have discarded as sentimental.
You expected Dalinar to turn, Teravangian thought. You wanted him for your champion. You failed. So in the end you were no smarter than I was. And for all your boasting that you can see the future, you do not know everything.
Teravangian had seen the god's plans once. Could he make it happen again? No, he didn't dare plot. He wasn't smart. He was only a man. But who better to stand up for men everywhere? In a moment of impassioned boldness, Teravangian reached into his pocket and took out the piece of the diagram he'd worked on. He held it close, as if for comfort. Odium took the bait. He strode over and snatched it from Teravangian's fingers.
What is this? Odium asked. Ah, another piece of your diagram, is it? Edited, I see. You think yourself so smart, do you?
No,
Teravangian whispered, hoarse.
I know nothing.
As well you should acknowledge it, Odium said, then held the papers up before himself and shredded them in a flash of light. This is nothing. You are nothing,
Teravangian cried out, grabbing one of the pieces as it fluttered. Odium waved, and for a second time Teravangian was given a glimpse of the god's plans, hundreds of thousands of panes of writing hovering as if on invisible glass. This was what Odium had shown him a year ago. It was intended to impress Teravangian with how thorough and extensive Odium's planning was. And Teravangian had managed to tempt him into showing it off, like a prized stallion. Storms. Odium could be tricked. By dumb Teravangian. Teravangian glanced around, trying to find the black portion he'd seen before. Yes, there it was, the corrupted writing, a section of plans ruined by Renarin Colin. The implications of that seemed profound now. Odium wasn't able to see Renarin's future. No one could. The scar had expanded. Taravangian turned away quickly, not wanting to draw Odium's ire. Yet right before looking away, Taravangian saw something half-consumed in the black scar. His own name. Why? What did it mean?
I'm close to Renarin, Taravangian realized. Everyone close to the boy has their future clouded. Perhaps that was why Odium was wrong about Dalinar.
Taravangian felt a surge of hope. Odium couldn't see Taravangian's future right now. Taravangian bowed his head and bit his lip, squeezing his eyes closed, hoping the tears at the corners of his eyes would be mistaken for tears of awe or fear.
"Resplendent, isn't it?" Odium asked. "I've wondered why she would give you a taste of what we can do. In some ways, you're the only one I can talk to. The only one who understands, if in a limited way, the burden I bear."
"You could have simply come and given me the order today, then left," Taravangian thought. "You talk instead. You're lonely. You want to show off. You're human."
"I will miss you," Odium said. "I'm pleased that you made me promise to keep the humans of Carbranth alive. They will remind me of you."
If Odium could be lonely, if he could boast, if he could be tricked, he could be afraid. Taravangian might be dumb, but when dumb, he understood emotion. Odium had incredible power, that was clear. He was a god in power, but in mind? In mind, he was a man. What did Odium fear? He would have fears, wouldn't he? Taravangian opened his eyes and scanned through the many hovering panes of description. Many were in languages he couldn't read, but Odium used glyphs for names. Taravangian looked for a knot of tight writing. He looked for letters that evoked terror, the terror of a genius. He found them, understanding them without being able to read them, in a knot near the black scar. Words written in cramped letters, circling a name being consumed by the scar. A simple, terrifying name. Zeth, the assassin in white. Trembling, Taravangian turned away. Odium began ranting again, but Taravangian missed what the creature said. Zeth, the sword. Odium feared the sword. Except Zeth was at Urethiru. Why was his name being consumed by the scar that represented Renarin? It didn't make any sense. Could Taravangian have misunderstood? It took him a painfully long time to see the obvious answer. Zeth was here, in the army, near Dalinar, who was in turn near Renarin. Dalinar must have brought Zeth in secret.
"You cannot conceive how long I've planned for this," Odium was saying, though the light was building within him again, his skin like thin paper.
He seemed not weak. A being who could spawn storms and destroy entire nations would never be weak. But vulnerable. Odium had bet so much upon Dalinar being his champion. Now that was in chaos. The god bragged about his plans, but Taravangian knew firsthand that you could plan and plan and plan. But if one man's choices didn't align to your will, it didn't matter. 1,000 wrong plans were no more useful than a single wrong one.
"Don't be too pained, Taravangian," Odium said. "Dalinar won't kill you immediately. He'll seek to understand. It has become his way. Poor fool. The old Blackthorn would have immediately murdered you, but this weaker version won't be able to help himself. He'll need to talk to you before he orders your execution."
"You're doing the same,"
Taravangian thought, a dangerous plan budding in his mind.
"You should have killed me."
Out loud he said,
"So be it. I have accomplished my goal."
"So you have," Odium said. "So you have. Go, my son. Make good on your part of our compact, and earn salvation for those you love."
The golden expanse faded, depositing Taravangian on the floor of his storm wagon. He opened his hand, finding the fragment of the diagram in it. But the other pieces were gone. They had vanished when the vision ended. That stunned him, for it implied that he had truly been in another place, that he'd taken the papers there with him, but only this one piece remained when he returned. He stared at the fragment for a long time, then forced himself into his seat. He took a moment to recover before digging into his satchel. He brought out the span reed board, oriented it, and positioned the pen. When he finally got a response, he wrote out two simple words. Do it. He had to go through with the betrayal, of course. He needed to keep his agreement. He had to protect Carbranth. That came before any other plot or plans. And any other such plots would have to be executed in such a way that Odium either did not know what he'd done or couldn't act against him to remove Carbranth's protections. It took less than 15 minutes for Dalinar's soldiers to arrive and break into his wagon, shattering the door and storming in with weapons drawn. Yes, they'd been waiting for his betrayal. Odium had his distraction. They'd need to dedicate weeks of frantic work to be certain the Vaden armies didn't gain too much of an advantage, and Dalinar would be occupied here, fighting off Taravangian's soldiers. Taravangian groaned as the soldiers seized his span reeds, a scribe among them reading the two words he'd sent. They didn't harm him. Odium was probably right. Taravangian likely had a few weeks before his execution. He found that he hurt less, felt less tired, as they bound and gagged him. It was painful, yes, but he could suffer a little pain, for he knew something powerful. A quiet, furtive secret as dangerous as the diagram had been. Taravangian had decided not to give up.
Part 3. Songs of Home. Kaladin, Navani, Dalinar, Venli, Eshonai, Yasna, Renarin. 44. Tinder, waiting for the spark. I find this format most comfortable, as it is how I've collaborated in the past. I have never done it in this way, and with this kind of partner. From Rhythm of War, page 1.
Kaladin jogged through the dark tunnels of Urethiru, teft across his shoulders, feeling as if he could hear his life crumbling underfoot with each step. A phantom cracking, like glass shattering. Each painful step took him farther from his family, farther from peace, farther into the darkness. He'd made his decision. He would not leave his friend to the whims of enemy captivity. But though he'd finally thought to take off his bloodied shoes, and now carried them with the laces looped around his neck, he still felt as if he were leaving stained tracks behind him. Storms. What did he think he could accomplish by himself? He was effectively disobeying the Queen's order to surrender. He tried his best to banish such thoughts and keep moving. He would have time later to ruminate on what he'd done. For now, he needed to find a safe place to hide. The tower was no longer home, but an enemy fortress. Syl zipped out in front of him, checking each intersection before he arrived. Stormlight kept him moving, but he worried what would happen when it ran out. Would his strength fail him? Would he collapse in the center of the corridor? Why hadn't he collected more spheres from his parents or Laro before leaving? He hadn't even thought to take the Stormform's axe. That left him unarmed, save for a scalpel. He was too used to having Syl as his shard blade, but if she couldn't transform... No, he thought to himself. No thoughts. Thoughts are dangerous. Just move. He pushed forward, relying on Syl, who sped toward a stairwell. The easiest way to lose themselves would be to find a hiding place on the uninhabited floors, perhaps somewhere on 11 or 12. He took the stairs 2 at a time, propelled by the pulsing light in his veins. His glow was enough to see by. Teft began muttering quietly, perhaps responding to the jostling. They reached the 7th floor, then started straight up toward the 8th. Here, Syl led him farther inward. Try as he might to ignore them, Kaladin continued to hear the echoes of his failure, his father's shouts, his own tears. He'd been so close, so close. He lost track of their location in the endless tunnels. The floor here wasn't painted to give directions, so he trusted in Syl. She zipped ahead to an intersection, spun around in a circle a few times, then shot to the right. He kept pace with her, though he was feeling Teft's weight more and more. "Just a second," he whispered to her at the next intersection, then rested against the wall, Teft still weighing heavily on his shoulders, and fished a chip from his pouch. The small topaz was barely enough to see by, but he needed it as the stormlight he was holding finally gave out, and he didn't have many spheres left. He grunted under the weight of his friend, then pushed himself to stand up straight, clinging tightly to Teft with both hands while gripping the sphere between 2 fingers. He nodded to Syl.